Broadcasted live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
A 30-year celebration of where we've been in the past 30 years. So this is going to be a special. Everything is a little bit different today. And just after that, we're going to be looking at the state of the province. We've got Premier Panyaza Lusufi coming through just after 9 o'clock. We'll have that conversation with him. But I have none other than Judge Grichler in studio with us. Really honoured to have you in studio. A very good evening and welcome.
Heidi, and good evening to the listeners.
So the whole point of this is to reflect on the 30 years post 1994, the very first elections. And it's really just a moment to take, go back memory lane and just to reflect on how we're doing. I want to take us back to the day you were requested to be the commissioner. My little bird tells me that you were on holiday and you got a phone call.
I got a phone call. I'd been at the beach and got back from the beach at lunchtime, and the maid said you'd had a phone call from the minister. I didn't know which minister or whoever. It was Minister Scutter, who was the
Home Affairs.
And he told me that I had been, as I heard, appointed to chair the electoral court.
That's what you heard.
What I heard, and I thought, that's fine. And I said, fine, if the Chief Justice is happy to give me permission to leave. Then a week later, as I was flying to Cape Town, I met a fellow traveller who congratulated me on being appointed to chair the Electoral Commission. And I said, no, I'm only the chair of the court. And he said, brother, have you got a surprise coming to you?
So the question then is, had you heard it correctly? Would you have said yes?
I suppose so, yes. In ignorance, I would have said yes.
There was obviously a lot of anxiety around this.
Oh, yes.
You know, some violence, the right wing violence. KZN was quite also unstable. A lot of anxiety, but a lot of excitement as well. People wanted to vote.
Not only did people want to vote, people were tired. People wanted peace. People, generally, the electorate, not only the leadership, but the electorate generally was keen to go through this rite of passage, to enter the sunny uplands, or whatever their dreams were. There was a general appreciation that the elections were a necessary step for the transition to the new South Africa.
So after that phone call near the beach with a lot of noise in the background and you're not quite hearing what it is that they were asking you, who actually then said to you, no, Judge Grichler, we are asking you to be the commissioner of the IEC?
I only heard it on the plane the following week. I had given up the rest of the holiday in order to go to Cape Town to this meeting, which I thought was of the court.
Yes.
It turned out to be of the commission. Yes. I heard it then. I was very surprised. And you asked whether I would have done what I did if had I known what I was doing. I suppose that goes to most of us. Yes, we would probably have done whatever we did, even though we didn't realize what we were doing.
Did you ever get a call from Madiba at the time?
Not at the time. The first time I got a private phone call from Madiba was 11 o'clock at night at home one night, when he phoned. And Madiba never, ever had a secretary phone you and say, hold the line for Mr. Mandela.
It would be directly with
it
him.
It was Madiba himself on the line. And of course, you could hardly remain seated at hearing the famous voice and the intonation of the man. And he phoned me. Things were going rather badly at that stage. It was the last week before the election. And he phoned to encourage me and say, hang in there, we'll get through this.
Because, I mean, you had the majority of South Africans who had never voted before.
correct.
You only had 4 months to prepare.
Whereas we needed probably closer to 18
or so.
To 4 years than 4 months.
Yeah.
2 years would have been a tight exercise.
Yeah. And people forget, I mean, technology wasn't as it is today. Very difficult to communicate as well.
You can't run an election without a voter's roll.
Yeah.
We didn't have a voter's roll. We didn't even have a national population register. We didn't even have a census figure that was agreed to be accurate. And as you say, technology. The IEC had about a dozen of the very, very first cell phones in the world. They were the size of a brick.
How long did that battery last?
About 4 hours. and of course, of the majority of the polling stations a serious number of the polling stations didn't have electricity, weren't communicable by telephone at all. We needed walkie-talkies that the military provided, shortwave radio, and so forth. It wasn't the South Africa that we're looking at today.
You needed to be given room to breathe because, as you said, you didn't have the voter's roll. So many things you were learning as you were going along. You needed space to do things, I suppose, creatively, one would say. IFP coming in very, very late at the last minute there to be added on to the ballot.
Yes, it was, of course, not IFP. Only the IFP that was reluctant to join the party. Northwest, Bopura Tswana, the regime there, the Mangope regime, was not keen to join. In the Ciskei, there was a resistance, and of course, there was right wing Afrikaner opposition. It was not clear until fairly soon, shortly before the election, that the Zion Africanists. African Church of Zion was going to be participating. We didn't know until Easter that actually they were going to join in the process, and that's several million South Africans.
How quickly was it to get the law to be changed for some polling stations to literally write IFP on them with a hand, because you didn't have enough stickers, you didn't have all the things that needed to go onto the ballot, because the IFP, you used stickers for the IFP.
If you will bear with me for a moment,
yes,
it's quite an interesting story.
Yes.
How Saturday afternoon I'm sitting in the IEC office in Christ Street, Johannesburg, when the head of the electoral administration comes in and says, there's a very big, very black gentleman to see you. It turned out to be a man by the name of Okubu, professor from Kenya, who had come to speak to Shenge. And he was going to persuade Shenge to join the show. You remember there had been 3 wise men sent by the international community.
Yeah.
And the IFP had turned them down.
Yeah.
But Okumu said he had the key. Could we still allow the IFP to join? This was the Saturday, before the election.
Did he ever tell you what was the key? What was the thing that got Mangosuthu Buthelezi to agree?
Essentially, the message was going to be, your name will live throughout Africa as the man who made the freedom of South Africa possible or who frustrated it. The choice is yours. And
whether that happened or not, we don't know.
But it sounded very good, so we said we could do it, and we then that evening sent the artwork for the printers
in the UK,
put it on the SAA flight to London, arranged with the printers to pick it up at Heathrow from the airline, from the pilot, and start the printing. We needed 80 million strips gum strips to stick on the bottom of the ballot paper.
And that wasn't enough.
Oy, that wasn't enough. We couldn't get them distributed to some places in the time available. So people were free to write in IFP on the ballot paper at the foot of the ballot paper if they wanted it.
It needed the change of law, though, to do that.
We changed the law after we changed the facts. We legitimized what we had decided afterwards. There wasn't time for Parliament to decide first and then we would do it. We did first and we said, please okay what we've done. And they did.
You speak of just how difficult it was leading up to the day and that phone call by Madiba. Do you know what necessitated phone call? What had happened that he felt that was the moment to call you to encourage you?
I think we'd had a particularly hostile media interview that particular evening. I'm reconstructing. I'm not really remembering
Absolutely.
This.
Sure.
I do know that I was pretty down.
Yeah.
Things were looking pretty ugly at the time when he phoned. He had obviously kept his hand on the pulse. He had realized that there was a headwind blowing pretty strongly, and he phoned just to say, hang in there, we're with you.
And remember, he wasn't the president.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't, although he was quite clearly the president-elect.
Yeah.
And de Klerk, to his credit, was the president, the state president. But he made no bones about it that he consulted Madiba on all of the key questions that I raised, at least. About the others, I can't say, but I know. My request, for instance, for extra time for changes of the law, the two of them considered it together and gave an answer.
Did the phone call do it? Did you feel better afterwards?
Of course I did. I was walking on air that Mandela had spoken to me.
Was it about what he said or that he called you?
No, saw fit to try to get my phone number even to phone me. No, I was tremendously boosted by it.
I just want to, again, look at then the challenges, the real challenges on the ground. Not enough ballot papers, just the kinds of technical difficulties that you ran into. Just give us anecdotal examples.
I must explain, first of all, elections are extremely complicated undertakings.
Yeah.
They are very, very much more difficult than people generally think. They're not only technically, administratively, in terms of logistics. You have to deliver to tens of thousands of individual points in the country. Literally millions of objects, ballot papers, marking ink, pens, lights, marking ink, ultraviolet lights, the works. To get it to all of the places all of the time, many of the places with no electricity. So you had to have the necessary alternative arrangements there, battery-driven stuff and so forth. Many of the places, no phone communication. We didn't know whether the stuff had arrived. You couldn't say that in that district of the Eastern Cape, all of the polling stations have now been provisioned with what they need. We didn't know how many people were to come to each polling station. We have no way of catering for the anticipated number of voters at the particular point. We were providing a customer-focused service without knowing where the customers were and how many there were.
Did you get the sense that even though you didn't have enough time to train the staff on the ground, they did what they had to because they knew it's the right thing to do? Did you have that sense that the IEC staff on the ground, even though there wasn't enough time to train them, even though things were difficult, they went in there wanting to serve this nation?
It was most certainly the sense of the commission, of all of the staff with which we interacted. It was a focal point of our training, was to motivate people to that effect, that this is you part of, you providing a celebration for the people. It's a privilege that to be part of the exercise.
Mm.
And overwhelmingly, yes. After the voting time, when it got to counting,
mm.
that's when we started running into labor problems with people saying they wanted more money.
Oh.
But but the voting station staff stuck to their job, even though they had to work infinitely longer than had been planned. The circumstances were extremely difficult. They were, as you say, ill-trained, barely trained, but highly motivated.
Part of the problem was that you didn't have enough security to open up more stations. You know, the police and the army just didn't have the capacity to deal with that.
Pamela, let's remind those of us who are old enough, and let's tell those of us who are too young to have known about it. The country was a very, very seriously troubled point in the late 80s and the early 90s, all the way up to the election, with KwaZulu being declared a national emergency state, with a high concentration of troops there, which meant that there were not sufficient troops in the rest of the country to provide cover for the number of polling stations we needed. There were people being killed in KwaZulu in particular, and on the East Rand, in what became Gauteng. There were serious disruptions in Ciskei. There was the televised killing in Bophuthatswana, and bombs going off even in central Johannesburg. There were threats by right-wingers and in khaki uniforms, people who had stormed the debating chamber during Kodesa's session. The country was on a knife's edge. We were in a very, very nasty position. There was tension, but there was a keen endeavor to get this election done, get it behind us.
I'm going to take a quick break, and I'm very, very happy to take your calls on 086-000-00959. I'm with Josh Krichler. We're going to do this all the way until 9 o'clock. Send those questions in. We're reflecting on 30 years of democracy in South Africa. Judge Johan Krichler is my guest as we reflect on the very first democratic election, 1994. Really a privilege to have this moment with him to reflect on the particular days leading up to the elections, and of course the day itself, and how we find ourselves here. I just want us to talk about the day when finally the day had arrived. And I mean, I remember the queues. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. I don't think anybody could believe. But what was incredible was the patience. That sight, and I know the visuals are there now, but in real time must have been breathtaking for you.
It was more than breathtaking, it was frightening. It was frightening because some polling stations ran out of ballot papers because they had a much bigger turnout than we had anticipated.
Yes.
They went to neighboring polling stations in High Corner. We don't know what's going to come, we can't lend you any.
Yes.
So they went to warehouses and they hopped for themselves. So we had shortages in places that we didn't know about. But and I would love to say that the lovely long snaking queues were an encouragement. It wasn't an encouragement. It was an indictment.
Sure.
We had not been able to provide sufficient facilities to enable people to cast their votes with reasonable comfort and ease.
And of course, it's funny now. I don't think it was funny then. I'm told you tell a story of one of the stations that ran out of the ink.
Oh, yes.
The infamous ink. And they started using water, hoping nobody will notice this was just water.
And nobody did notice. We also ran out, we managed to get ink from the original ink was made in the United States,
yes.
A very highly secret formula.
Yes.
When that ran out, where do you think we went? We went to the police head laboratories, and they created the same ink for us within a couple of hours.
I mean, look at that.
Yes.
We could have done it all along.
We could have. No, we couldn't. It was a question of credibility.
Capacity. Okay.
Credibility.
Gotcha.
Same reason that the ballot papers were printed abroad. Mm. It had to be as objective as outside the hands of anybody involved in the process.
I hear you. And there is a story you tell of, obviously, the boxes running out themselves, being too full. And now here you are. You have some officials making a plan with jeans and clothing material to try and tie it up. And there was just trust. Nothing else but just trust.
Pamela, yes, it was. In fact, it was part of the success of the election as a rite of passage in our transition, that it was so imperfect, that it required people to use spaza shop ingenuity, and like filling a pair of jeans. Pulled tight at the top with a belt and knotted at the bottom of the legs.
And stick it in the corner of the building.
Because that was done, because people had to stand in the queues for hours, people talked to one another. Many, many people of different colours spoke to people of the different colour for the first time ever in those queues. They were confronted with the same irritation and the same weight, and that consolidated them with one another. It was part of the success of the process that it involved so many changes and adaptations by the people themselves, understanding why it was being done, and that was important. The IEC was patently, painfully transparent in everything it did. And it also established its credibility so that the electorate could say, maybe not doing such a good job, but they're honest and they're doing their best. And it's our election. We saw to it that through a system of liaison committees from national down to the district level, we had liaison with the political parties at all times. And come 27 April, the general spirit in the political circles was, here we go, this is our election, let's go now. It wasn't us and the IEC and casting stones at them. There was criticism, yes, but by and large the sense was the IEC is part and parcel of a national effort and we're all together in it.
I want to talk a little bit about your own experience, because I think people don't remember, those who are not old enough to have been there, don't remember that feeling. Some don't remember the feeling of each and every single one's casting of their own vote, because it was different, I think, for white South Africans, black South Africans. Personally, what was that like?
I had decided that I shouldn't vote. I shouldn't, because I'm so objectively impartial.
Absolutely.
But I was persuaded by my staff that that would be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That would be showing an unwillingness to vote, and that's a wrong example to set. And I did vote. I can remember voting to this day, but every single time I vote for Mello, I get goosebumps. It is, to me, a symbolic action of such significance that I get a lump in my throat when I vote, because I think of the many people who never did have that privilege, and here I have it, and it makes me a human being. It recognizes my dignity. That day, to me, it felt like that, but then it always does when I vote.
We then got to the day, as we said, long queues. And you were saying earlier that, yes, it was quite lovely in the beginning, but after a while, the staff got a little bit agitated. They're already tired. The counting was taking too long. They wanted more money. Yeah. Let's talk about those long hours, because it does get exhausting. Once they start counting, no sleep. You know, they can't leave. It's difficult.
Yes. The process was a little more complicated.
Yeah.
Nowadays, we count at the polling station,
yeah,
which is the logical thing to do and is universally accepted as preferable.
Mm.
We couldn't do that in 94.
Mm.
There wasn't sufficient security to safeguard ballot boxes at polling stations.
Yeah.
So what we had was, I think, about 70 counting centers.
Mm.
Ballot boxes were brought to the counting centers. There they had to be identified, organized, and then opened and counted. That process broke down when we extended the days of voting.
Yes.
Polling station staff, having sat for 3 days,
yeah,
said, I'm hot for life, I've had enough.
Yeah.
They came and they dumped the ballot boxes at the counting centers and said, I'm not waiting to sign on and sign off. Good night, I'm going home.
Mm.
So we had large numbers of ballot boxes insufficiently certified.
Mm.
And there was a major holdup at Nasrec. By the Saturday afternoon after the voting, that afternoon I was called there. They hadn't opened a single box.
Sure.
And there were thousands of boxes piled up there. Close to a fifth of the country's votes were in that center.
Mm.
It just had to be counted.
Mm.
And I had to take the awesome decision to say you count, notwithstanding the fact that procedurally, technically, the ballot boxes have not been sufficiently identified.
Mm.
I was satisfied, and the commission was, which supported me subsequently, were satisfied that there was sufficient security to ensure that no illegal votes were counted.
Mm.
But it was technically imperfect, and having to cut that corner was an awesome decision that I had to take on the run there and then. And I said, you count now. Open the boxes and count. Never mind that the forms that have to identify them have not been provided and have not been signed off.
Mm.
Fortunately, the political representatives at the counting center saw the wisdom of it, and we started counting. And in the result, we could finish on time, which was very, very tight scheduled.
Mm. Mm.
We had to finish on the Friday, because Parliament had to meet over the, convene over the weekend, meet on Monday, vote in Madiba as president so that he could be inaugurated on Tuesday at the Union Buildings, where the whole world and his mother-in-law had been invited. There was a very, very tight schedule.
You later opened up about counting the KZN numbers.
Yes.
And that decision that had to be made. Let's talk about that.
There was nothing. No. The decision had to be taken about the central Gauteng voting at Nasrec.
Mm.
At the central Gauteng center in Durban, a similar decision had to be taken.
Mm.
It wasn't a difficult decision because there was no alternative.
Mm-hmm.
One point had to be emphasized, and that is that every single ballot that was issued to a voter had to have on the back of it a stamp applied by the presiding officer when it was issued.
Mm.
A ballot that didn't have a stamp on it wouldn't be counted. A ballot that had a stamp on it would be counted, irrespective of what it looked like or where it came from. That decision was backed up in Natal. There is a suggestion that a large number of illegal votes were counted. That's wrong.
Mm.
What happened was, because IFP came in so late. An extra 600 polling stations had to be identified, equipped, staffed, and supervised within the 9 days that were available. Many of those polling stations were inadequately identified in the government gazette. Many of them had to be changed at the last minute. No, I am satisfied that not one single ballot paper cast in KwaZulu-Natal was not counted. And I'm equally convinced that no ballot paper that wasn't lawfully cast was included in the count. The process was rough and ready in KwaZulu, yes. The process was disorganized, yes. It had to be. It could not be perfect. That staff hadn't even been trained to the limited extent that they had been elsewhere. And also, and this is a saving grace, the overwhelming majority of the people who voted in Heartland KwaZulu were IFP voters anyway. The ANC was strong in the urban areas. IFP was bedrock in the rural areas. So the fact that you had largely IFP civil servants manning the polling stations made very, very little difference to the legitimacy of the process as a true reflection of the will of the people in that particular constituency. Likewise in the Eastern Cape, where it was quite clearly partisan ANC staff in the polling stations. They were going to vote ANC anyway. They weren't going to vote IFP or DA or as it then was, or NP. It made very little difference. The process in the end was substantially a fair reflection of the will of the people.
And obviously, because things were so tense, as you're saying, in some regions, the KZN region being a case in point, was there nervousness about the results before the rest of them came in, as you're saying? They came in late. Was there a moment where things were tense about which way it's going to go?
Certainly.
Because KZN was difficult at the time.
Not so much which way things were going to go. I think that that was one thing that made the election relatively easy in this respect, that the outcome, by and large, was predictable, that the ANC would get a major share of the votes, well over half, that the Nats would get the solid lot in the Cape, and that the IFP would get a solid lot in the then Natal. That it worked out precisely as it did, yes, that was only discovered once the count had been done, but by and large it was fairly predictable. So we weren't surprised.
I need to take a quick break and I'll be back with more in a short while. Very open to take your voice notes. I'll also look at your exes and I'll take your calls on 086-000-0959. Jash Krichler is with us as we look back 30 years ago when we first went to the ballot as a democratic South Africa. I just want us to talk a little bit, Jash Krichler, on the significance of South Africa being able to conduct the elections in the way that they have. I think we can be proud. Six elections, and the world somehow gets the sense that we're doing okay. Very rare for a country as young as ours.
I am exceedingly proud of our electoral record since then. Not only the IEC, but the political parties, the political leadership, and the rank-and-file South African voters have, as you say, have produced six exemplary elections, which is very, very rare in emergent democracies such as ours, with our background of strife and grave differences in in the community, for us to have produced this is quite remarkable.
Mm. Everyone has to play their part, including the citizens. Fewer and fewer South Africans are going to the ballot. Does that concern you?
It is certainly a concern of mine. I see it in a broader context. Mm-hmm. I think that we had the honeymoon of liberation, which anticipated, one could anticipate, much greater support. We've got a little tired in the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
It's lost a bit of its spark. There's quite a lot of disenchantment. That's a political problem. It's not an electoral problem.
Mm.
It's a national reaction to a little bit of tiredness with our democracy, a little bit of boredom with the same old stories from the same old politicians. How we get out of it is a different question.
Mm.
At the moment, we have quite a lot of excitement.
Mm.
I'm not sure that, as an electoral administrator, I like excitement in elections.
but we are also testing our democracy quite a bit. The IEC themselves also wanting to be sure that they are doing the right thing, going this, what we've seen in the media now, they're going to the Constitutional Court to clarify a few things. We are pushing the envelope quite a bit, testing, checking whether we are on the right track. Does that encourage you, or does it make you nervous?
No, it encourages me and it makes me nervous.
Okay.
I'm encouraged that there is sufficient support, political contestation,
mm-hmm.
for cases to be presented, for there to be disputes.
Mm.
It is good that we do no longer have the monotony of one overwhelming party,
mm.
being confident that however much it fouls up, it's going to be re-elected. It's good that there's contestation.
Mm.
It's good for democracy. It makes for higher tension,
mm-hmm.
greater temptation to cut corners,
mm.
greater temptation for tempers to rise, for passions to overflow. The risks of violence are greater, the
mm-hmm.
greater the contestation,
mm-hmm.
but also greater the quality of the democracy. I think the IEC is coping with it at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's maintained a cool attitude. I think it has done the right thing to go to court on the issue that it did.
Mm.
I think that the decision to take on appeal, the decision of the electoral court, is a sensible one, particularly as there was a difference of opinion,
yes.
as between the judges on that court.
Mm.
In those circumstances, I think it would have been irresponsible not to have taken the matter further.
Mm.
And let's see what the CC says about the dispute. It's good that we get a final authoritative word on the issues involved.
Are you confident that this country is now mature enough to accept whatever outcome the elections bring out?
No. I don't think that anybody can be confident of that. We saw July 2 years ago that there is an element that is prepared to incite, that there is a segment of society which is susceptible to being incited. There is certainly a risk that a major perceived fault in the election could elicit a lot of violence. Significant violence in several places.
Mm.
I don't think that there is a major risk, but there's always a possibility that we should be aware of.
How do we deal with that?
We deal with that, number one, by every single political party, from the leadership down through all the ranks, accepts the code of conduct,
mm-hmm.
to which it committed itself. that the media in general report responsibly. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that they should restrain themselves, but they should be aware of the implications of inciting excitement, animosity at this stage. I think that by and large, the electorate, particularly those who indulge in social media, should be aware of the fact that we're surrounded by hay. Drawing matches is not a good idea.
What is your biggest concern with an environment like this right now?
I don't think I could honestly identify one particular concern as greater than the other. At this stage, I'm concerned that somebody somewhere is going to get the bright idea that it's to her or his or their advantage to have the elections postponed. That must not happen at any price. We are committed to going to the polls on the 29th of May, and we must vote then.
What are the consequences of a South Africa that doesn't, whatever the constituency, that does not accept the results?
Well, certainly, economically speaking, it will be disastrous. That it's been remarkable that the rand has kept its value throughout the gewalt that we've had with the emergence of the brand new party and the resurgence of the former president. The markets have stayed quiet about it. If we were to have a real violence, we could have once again a serious blow to our economy. And our economy doesn't affect only the people who have shares that are quoted on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. It affects each and every one of us if the economy takes a knock. It would be politically a serious setback. I think we have established a track record of responsible voting. It would be a tragedy if we were to spoil that reputation.
So what's missing in this equation right now?
In this equation right now, what is missing, I'm sad to say, is inspired, bold leadership. Not populist leadership, not cheap promises, but actually national wisdom, advisable conduct, as it was in the days of Madiba.
Yeah. You said earlier that, you know, the honeymoon is over and people are a little bit tired. And I suppose when one looks at history, it's normal in a way.
Yeah.
Did you expect South Africa to be this tired this soon?
Frankly, the ANC has disappointed me. I don't think it has lived up to the promises it made or to the promise that it held. I think it's not only the dark days of the Zuma era that set us back. I think that there was a general sliding back on the spirit of broad South African consolidation and reconciliation that we saw in the years 93-94. We've lost, I've used the image of the honeymoon. The interaction between all segments of society has taken a knock. It's not as good as it was. You know it, I know it, we feel it. We feel it in interaction with one another.
Mm. You know, young people often talk about how badly so they think. And when they point to the mistakes, they say, but you guys allowed an Oranje to happen. And you are surprised that we are a divided nation, for instance, one of the many examples. And you want to tell us you are all happy together, really? How do you respond to that?
It's easy to be a cynic. It's cheap to be a cynic. It is stupid to be a cynic because you can never win. If you don't have confidence in yourself and in your community and in your society, you should get the hell out of it. It doesn't help to propagate negative views. I understand the... that sounds condescending. Mm. I realize that I cannot understand the depth of frustration of the younger generation. I intellectually I can grasp it. Mm. Emotionally I can't make it my own. Mm. Certainly my generation, your generation, have failed the country. Mm. We have not produced what we could have produced, what we should have produced. We have not progressed at all in reducing the Gini factor, the difference, the vast, indefensible difference between the haves and the have-nots.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers of people living below or barely below the above the breadline has not diminished, it's grown.
Mm.
The standard of national education has deteriorated in the last 30 years. The chances of a new inspired creative generation growing up is really a fool's paradise.
Mm.
As long as the educational system, as lamentably poor as it is at the moment,
mm.
we've got a way to go. The youngsters are entitled to be angry.
Mm.
But I suggest instead of being angry, they started getting busy.
When you speak to many South Africans, we've just been talking about young people. There's a cynicism in the air. Not real optimism in the air at the moment. Are you optimistic?
No. Mm-hmm. I'm not optimistic in the short term. I'm optimistic. I'm confident in the long term. I'm not optimistic in the short term because I believe that we are in a phase which is inevitable in a society that was driven for 300 years by colonialism and then for the last 50 or so years by a statutorily reinforced, harsher form of colonialism than before. To think that we could overcome that in 10 or 20 or 30 years is pie in the sky.
Mm.
I didn't think so in the 90s. I still don't think so. I think it will take generations for us to come right, but we will.
And how do you think we're going to do that? What makes you so optimistic in the long run?
I've been around. I've been around in Africa.
Yeah.
I've been around in the world. I've conducted and managed elections in dozens of places.
Mm.
Francophone, Anglophone, Africa, the Arab world, Far East. There is a sense of cohesion in South Africans generally, notwithstanding the attempts of politicians to accentuate the differences.
Mm.
The simple example is how we all enjoy successes on the sports field, whether it's been a sprinter winning the 100 meters at the Diamond celebration contests in Europe, or winning a World Cup or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the general sense of belonging, of co-belonging, that I encounter in this country, I didn't find it, for instance, in Kenya, where I worked for nearly a year. I didn't find it in Liberia or Sierra Leone, where I worked. Mm. I didn't find it in Zimbabwe. Didn't find it anywhere other than here. There's an Afrikaans word for which the English translation is tricky, but there is a generalized, concerted commitment to our destiny.
Mm.
We know that we are bound to live with one another, survive with one another, and succeed with one another. We have mental resources, human resources, material, mineral resources, a climate that is unfriendly in some places, but generally lends itself to high quality farming. We have the highest developed industrial economy on the continent. We were at one stage clearly the leader. We can once again be the leader. We should once again be the leader in once we can get our infrastructure restored, our transport, our power. It can be done. It will be done, but not in my lifetime.
Oh, oh. What a way to end it. What a way to end it. I really appreciate you coming through. Thank you so much for your reflections.
I love being here. Thank you for inviting me.
Judge Johan Krichler, thanks for your time.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.